Hey, movie lovers, you can enjoy Real Nerds Podcast in many ways. You can go to our website, realnerdspodcast.com. There you'll find articles and the podcast. You can go to our YouTube channel, and you will see the Real Nerds Pod Show. We're also on Blue Sky. Hey, did you know Facebook is still a thing for people? Yep, we're on there too. We are also on Threads. There are many ways to interact with us. All our film adventures are posted on Instagram. If you have a social media account, you can find the Real Nerds Podcast.
Camera, action!
Well, a real nerd knows who shot, and a real nerd can follow the plot, and a real nerd
just
can...
talk to film! I'm sorry.
Take it outside.
Well, a real nerd knows who shot, and a real nerd can follow the plot, and a real nerd will give it all they got. Lights, camera, action!
Hey, Real Nerd listeners, welcome to another exciting episode of the Real Nerds Podcast, where every week we see a new movie and we podcast our experience to the world. This week, we saw 28 years later, The Bone Temple. And we're actually caught up, Brad. I can't believe I had like this brain like stop working moment there.
Yeah, that was a total boner move.
It was a boner move. That's what boner used to mean, is you messed up. Not a hard on.
Famously, the Joker does a boner in one of the early Batman comics.
That is correct. One of the many memes from early Batman, you know, that and smacking Robin and, you know, there's just a bunch. But the 1940s were a simpler time. Stay tuned. We'll recommend the film or not, play the trailer and then spoil it. We also have nerd news and stuff we watch throughout the week. We see movies. That's what we do. We see movies. How about you?
We've done that rhyme a lot. But yeah, that's our job, is to watch movies and report back to you, our listeners.
Yes.
We've loved doing it for 14 years, and we won't stop. Nothing can stop us.
No, nothing.
Not even
nothing
the government.
Can stop us now. No. Yeah. So, Brad, this week we saw 28 years later. Do you recommend this film?
You know what? I was surprised how much I actually enjoyed this. Like, the movie from last year was fine, but, like, the ending of this movie fucking rules. So what was, like, a 3-star movie instantly became, like, a 4-star movie.
Yeah, there's
the way this thing ends.
I agree. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I mean, I liked the one from last year. But, this one just has the ending made it kind of wicked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Here's a trailer for 28 years later, The Bone Temple.
This is a memorial to the dead. So, is this all you're doing?
It is.
Are you Old Nick?
Old Nick? You mean Satan?
Yes. Old Nick released his demons unto the world of man. And the world of man fell before the demons.
I remember details, events, and people. The world had an order.
What's your name?
Spike.
No, I think your name is Jimmy.
The foundations. They seemed unshakable. Infected attack. What do they see?
A
I believe the infection can be treated. And now, a leap into the unknown.
This film picks up pretty much immediately after the 28 years later, where little Spike has been recruited, captured by the Jimmy gang. Gone are the kung fu moves and like the flips.
Yeah, that threw me off at first because, you know, at the end of the last movie, I pictured them as being like a heroic force in this wasteland. And right away, the movie shows you like, no, these guys are psychopaths.
Yeah, you know, and it's, it opens with Spike in this abandoned swimming pool. And what I liked about this film is it kind of slowly unraveled who the Jimmies were. And so there's only room in their gang for 7 of them. And to be in the gang, you either have to kill one guy or they kill you.
No reason for 7. It's just arbitrary.
Yeah.
Because Jimmy says so.
Yeah, and he says a lot of things.
Well, it might be based on some Bible thing, but I don't know what that is.
No, I don't either. But I mean, like, he's just full of himself.
Is it 7 apostles? Maybe that's why?
Maybe, or I thought it was made to do with the devil's fingers. Does he only have 7 fingers? I don't know.
Oh, maybe.
Worship my devil dick.
It'd be lopsided, because it would be like 4 and 3.
Yeah, I don't know. Religion is something I've not majored in at any point in my life, because it's bullshit. Spike does kill one of the Jimmies, and he's given the name, everybody's name, to Jimmy. There's Shite Jimmy. I don't forget what the girl who dances like the Teletubbies, she has a name too, but they're basically all the Jimmies.
Yeah, they're all Jimmy. Everyone's Jimmy.
And then we also go back to Dr. Rolston, who... if you remember from the last one, Samson is kind of the alpha zombie, and he's this jacked up Dr. Indian Kelson guy. And Ralston thinks he can.
It's Kelson. Sorry,
Kelson. Sorry, thank you, Kelson. Kelson thinks he can. I don't know. I guess reason with him, because he slowly discovers that when he gives him the morphine, that maybe if he gives him an antipsychotic drug, that the reason these infected are lashing out is because they're seeing stuff that's not there.
Yeah.
And
he thinks there's a psychological component to the rage virus,
which he ends up being right about. And he kind of develops a friendship with Samson. And what's really cool about this film is there is some, you know, infected gore and things like that, but that's not what's at the heart of this film. It's just like the last one is, you know, about a mother's journey. This one is not everything is what it seems. And even when there's these quiet moments with Samson and you know, when he's walking on that train that's all dilapidated, and he's kind of seeing where he came from and how he got infected and how he grew into this alpha. It's really fascinating. And it does follow actually a zombie trope. Even though these aren't zombies again, but in the Romero trilogy, the third part, there was a doctor in there who thought he could control what the zombies were doing by giving them a reward. So he would give the zombie bub, you know, pieces of human if he did something well. And this one kind of follows the same pattern, where maybe what's bothering the infected can be cured if you can't cure the actual infection. And because there's what's cool is the film, as he keeps on getting these treatments,
is his eyes slowly come back to normal eyes. You know, they're not that bloodshot, yellow kind of color.
Yeah.
On the other side, you have the Jimmies find this kind of cornered off area, and they come. They overtake this farm and this family, and while they're there, it kind of goes sideways, which leads them to leaving there. And, you know, Jimmy always talks about his dad, Old Nick, which is code for the devil. And when he sees Kelson, he associates him with, well, nope, that yeah. one girl sees him first. Sorry.
Yeah. While everyone's being murdered at the farm, one of his Jimmies is sent out to like look ahead the surrounding areas, and she sees the Bone Temple. And because she's been fed this propaganda of like Jimmy's aura, I guess, about like, you know, they're on this quest to find the devil, she thinks she's found the devil. And then Jimmy's like thrown for a loop, thinking like, oh my God, am I right? Was all my bullshit right for once? Everything I've been feeding these kids, like, actually true? That, and then when he finally meets Kelson, he's just like, oh, it's a bit of relief, and you're kind of fun to talk to. But also, like, if you destroy my what is it?
I guess
my mythos?
Yeah, or his lie he's been telling.
Yeah, then I'll kill you. So he basically blackmails Kelson into playing along and pretending to be the devil.
Yeah, and that part's wicked.
Yeah.
He puts on Iron Maiden.
Yeah. I think the name of Technic show.
Yeah, and Sign of the Beast, I think, is the name of it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so he puts on this huge show. And when they get down there, he realizes that Spike's one of them. But Spike really isn't. He's trying to get away. And
he's just surviving. Like, he's playing along with whatever he needs to do to survive.
And then Kelson recognizes that and says that the boy needs to stay, which throws Jimmy in a loop, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, Kelson he turns his own disciples against him by saying, like, what was it?
I can't remember.
Yeah, what was the actual twist to make him turn on Jimmy?
Well, it's that one girl, too, where, you know, they said, wait, he said this, and now you don't want us to do what they're following? Something like that. And they all start attacking Jimmy, and he stabs Kelson, and...
Yeah, like, that whole thing would have been good enough, but when they finally, like, take down Jimmy, and the one girl nails him upside down to the cross...
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, it's even better.
Yeah, and I love the it's not, I guess not a reveal, but the showing of Samson. It Jimmy thinks that he looks like Lucifer, you know, coming up, and he gets, you know, his head ripped off, so, or something.
I was gonna say, like, even though Samson isn't raged out, he still has like the strength to like rip an entire dude's like spine out.
You see how fucking jacked he is and how big his cock is? Fuck. Well, that was interesting, too, because he was running around, you know, naked. And then when his rage was subsiding, he started wearing a loincloth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's starting to get back some of his humanity.
Feels shame.
Yes. yeah. And the one, what was the name of the Jimmy lady? She tells it to him at the end, and I can't remember now.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy Inc.
Yeah, but she actually reveals her real name, and I forget it. But anyways, they leave, and I guess I heard that Cillian Murphy was in this movie, but he doesn't show up till the very end.
Yeah, which makes sense, because, like, yeah, I'd say that shit for the third one.
Yeah, if they make the third one.
<We'll> yeah. <see. laughs> Yeah, I'm a little surprised that this didn't do as well as the previous one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing they probably still will. I guess what you do is you just...
They can't be that expensive to make.
I think this one was like $65 million.
Oof.
Yeah.
How? Like, there's barely any zombies in it. Well, infected in it.
Yeah. Whoa, whoa. You watch your mouth.
Yeah. There's not like a ton of fight scenes or anything.
No, it's more of an, you know, an examination of what happened and how can we come back.
I think it's more of just like, it just moves the whole mythos forward. Like, it's, you're yeah. not watching it. It definitely feels like a different movie from the others, which is nice.
Oh, I agree.
Like you're experiencing new stuff, like, and just pushing, you know, people actually like driving towards something.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting. Like I said online, the one woman who escaped from the farm, the pregnant woman who escaped from the farm, is like a loose end. And now, Jimmy Ink and Spike have crossed paths with Killian Murphy and his daughter. And assuming his mom's still, her mom's still around, maybe, but
yeah.
So the pregnant woman has to eventually tie in. And when she sees Spike again, it's probably going to be like all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. I guess they're inferring that he hooked up with, what's her name? Naomi from
yeah.
the first one, if I remember right. I might be misremembering. But I didn't know, because, you know, you and I both have movie collections. The Blu-ray I bought of 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later has been out of print for like 12 years, and it goes for hundreds of dollars online.
Weird.
I know, right? Well, I didn't know, too, my Dogma Blu-ray was out of print and it was going for over $100.
Well, that one I knew, yeah.
I had no idea. Well, obviously, not, probably not now. I mean, I got the 4K of Dogma, but...
Yeah, no, that those prices went down for sure.
It's just interesting to me. I was like, oh, who knew?
But yeah, like 28 Days seems like a relatively popular movie.
Yeah.
Being, it's for Sony, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's as simple as two. You know, the criterion of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you would have thought that that would have had, you know, a super special edition before now.
Yeah, no, I guess like it wasn't as revered like the past 20 years as it is right now. I guess probably because Paul Rubens died, so it's probably more present in people's lives than it was, you know, just 10 years ago.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, no, I you know, I mean, back to 28 years later, the Bone Temple, it was just cool. You know, Ralph Fiennes in it is awesome. And it's just, you know, even that, I remember that last scene, Laura loves Iron Maiden, so she was really excited. And I had no idea. Laura did not see 28 Years Later with me. I could have sworn she did. And so luckily we went to the Alamo and they had about a 15-minute, you know, previously on, which was good.
Yeah, that's surprising, but she wasn't too confused.
No, I mean, it's pretty... I mean, I think you probably still watch this movie cold and be on, oh.
Yeah, other than Spike, it's really not, there's not a lot of connections to the other, well, the Doctor and Samson are from the other movie, but like the movie is half about them, so it's not like.
Yeah, but I think you could be able to piece together that, you know, he's an infected and the Doctor's trying to save him. And
yeah, his whole story works without the other movie, so.
Yeah.
He's like a guest star in the other movie.
Correct. But there is still some sweet zombie action, you know. There's when Samson rips people's heads off, like Sub-Zero is pretty sweet.
Or the Predator.
Or the Predator, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty gnarly. Like, he does it, what, twice? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah,
it was just cool. I'm totally interested in what happens in the third one, if it ever happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, that whole finale with the fire and metal and just tricking these easily led automatons into thinking he's the devil and turning him against Jimmy, who's, ugh. We even talk about like their torture scene. Oh, when the pregnant lady drops the hook from the barn ceiling into that girl's head.
Oh, yeah.
What a great shot of just like you're watching her talk to whoever's on the ground and just like she just stops.
Yeah.
You're a thud. Yeah.
Yeah. I told Laura that Jimmy in that is the vampire from Sinners, and she couldn't believe it.
Yeah, so unrecognizable.
And he does such a great job in that, in both films, actually. So, and my wife has this huge crush on Cillian Murphy, too. So she's really excited that he came back.
Like 5 minutes before, and it's like, look, let's leave early. She's like, no, wait. I bet something good's going to happen. Yeah. Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, I agree. My
favorite of that whole series.
Is that nice. One.
Yeah.
Hey, let's check out the nerd news of the week.
It's real news.
Hey, Brad, do you have Superman number one lying around by any chance?
The Christopher Reeve one?
No, the comic book.
Oh, the one from the 30s?
Yeah, Nick Cage is Superman number one. Was graded at 9.0. And it sold last week for $15 million. So if you have one of those lying around, dude, I mean, you're set for life.
You know what? I have like six, no, like I have 10 boxes here. I'll flip through one more time and make sure I don't have it.
Yeah, just double check. You never know. It could have fallen through the cracks.
I think I'm the first person in my family to ever collect comics, so I'm definitely sure I have it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think the last time it went on sale was only like a million or something. So, like,
yeah,
it being Nicolas Cage's copy probably added to the value.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, the Mile High collection is considered a prestige collection. And I'm guessing because Nick Cage owned it, that makes it more valuable.
So do you think he doesn't have to make as many movies now because he has $15 million? So he's going to like take a break?
I don't know if he sold it or he sold it previously and then someone resold it. Oh. I don't know the history behind that.
Well, in that case, yeah, he probably sold it when he needed money. And then whoever bought that decided to sell it. And they added to like, well, this used to be Nick Cage's. And so he got way more money than Nick Cage got.
Yeah. Man, I was reading this interesting factoid that comic books are one of the few collectibles that always either retain their value or grow in value.
Unless you're a 90s comic.
Oh, dude, no, that's not true either. So Venom Lethal Protector, which is a total shit comic, but I have the first two or three issues because, you know, I collect comics and then like Venom sucks. And for the longest time, it was one of those ones you could always find for $2 or $3 because there's, you know, I think probably a million of them. The last few times I've been in comic stores, they're selling for like $30 or $40. And I go, what a piece of shit fucking comic to be selling for that much. But, you know, I don't understand it. Well, did you add Ultimate or Absolute Batman to your poll?
No, I stopped getting Batman comics a bunch of years ago. I only get Turtles now.
So I only get Batman. And at our comic store, they'll put, they'll just put those sometimes into my hold slot, you know, more so Spider-Man. I told them just anything Spider-Man, just put in my hold slot. I don't give a shit. And, but because I have the mainline Batman, they put Absolute Batman in there. And I read it, and I said, oh, that's okay. And I told the guys, I says, hey, man, you don't have to put the next issue in there. I don't foresee me, you know, keep on reading this. And they said, oh, that's fine, that's fine. Dude, the first issue of that is selling for over $150 now.
Wow.
And it's not even been out for a year, so I'm gonna totally fucking trade that comic in. I'm going to get a really old Spider-Man with it because I'm waiting for it to burst.
You got me curious. I was looking up my second printing of Ninja Turtles number one. I don't know if Mile High, I think Mile High says they have it, and they're selling it for $6,200.
Wow.
So I bought that for 80.
Yeah, so with Mile High prices, take off about 30% of it, or 40.
The very first printing is going for 16,000. So.
Yeah, well, Ninja Turtles too, those have been slowly, it's one of the, I guess they consider that the Bronze Age. It's the number one comic from that era. So.
Yeah. But even like, God, down to like, what's this issue? 7 is like $138. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the absolute Batmans, every single one is worth so much money. It's insane. It reminds me a lot of when Ultimate Spider-Man came out in 2000. And
that's crazy for like a recent comic, though.
Oh, yeah. It's insane. It is insane. And that's why, you know, I don't collect Batman. Well, I collect some Batman, but, you know, I love Spider-Man and I'm trying to fill in my Amazing run, which I will never, ever have, you know, Amazing One and some of those ones. But if I can trade in a comic I don't care about and get 70, 80 bucks for it, and I can get, I don't know, Amazing Spider-Man, I don't know which one I need, I'll just say 47. I'll do that all day long. Because I care about it.
Do they just make like, do they just not print a lot of Absolute Batmans? Is that why?
Oh, no, well, what happened was, this is what I was told by the comic guys, is that people were late to wanting to get on it, and the final order cutoff happened. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's on its 10th print. I'm not even joking. So it definitely has it. And I have the Jim Lee variant cover, which surprisingly is like selling for $30 less than the just standard one. But yeah, so that I'm going to ask if they want it. I mean, if they don't want it, then it doesn't matter. But I say, hey, Absolute Batman number one, I have it. And if you just give me that Spider-Man on the wall there, we'll call it good.
Even trade.
Even trade. And it could be like a $40, $50 Spider-Man. I don't care. That's how I roll.
Cool.
Yeah. And that's the new nerd news I got this week. Brad, do you know we not only go see movies, but we watch movies and stuff throughout the week?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know that.
Well, I didn't know. I'm just asking. I'm asking the questions everyone's afraid to ask.
Only been watching movies outside of our movie for 14 years.
In a segment we call What We've Been Watching.
So, this is the stuff we've been watching.
Before the podcast, I never watched movies outside of theater movies ever. So it's been a wild ride.
So it's a good thing that we do this podcast then.
Yeah. Like you get to see so many more movies that way.
Yes. What'd you watch this week, my friend?
Oh, boy. Quite a bit as I click back to Letterboxd. Let's see. I saw Brick. So
Joseph Gordon-Levitt one?
Yeah. Riggle's been doing like the first films of famous filmmakers all month of January.
Oh, Ryan Johnson.
Johnson's. Yeah, Brick. I'd watched it before, but like didn't get it that well. And I wouldn't say I understood it much better the second time. But it is like an interesting, you know, it's a noir detective mystery movie. Starring high school students, or at least adults playing high school students, about Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He plays, I forget his character's name, but,
Brick.
I don't remember Brick either. Yeah. No, the Brick is like a brick of cocaine, I think. And his whole story revolves around his girlfriend breaks up with him and he's really sad. And then he finds out she's died. And then he goes on a quest to find her killer.
He's fucking dead.
And yeah, the movie just treats like all these suspect him and all these suspects like a 1940s noir movie, set in the present time, 2005. It's like really, I don't know. The dialogue is so like unrelatable. It like, it's so dialed into that era. I don't know. It's like hard to follow what they're saying a lot of times. Everyone commits to it and it's interesting. I think he's done better stuff since this, but it's a good start.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah. It's just like really tough to follow.
But you know, what's cool about it is you can see that he's he'd be a promising filmmaker. It definitely lends itself to that.
Yeah. Plenty of potential. Just Gordon-Levitt gets punched in the face like so much. Like every scene he's in, someone punches him in the face or something. And then along that theme, they showed Christopher Nolan's first film, which is Following, which I own.
I haven't seen that one in a long time.
Yeah, I own it, but I haven't in a while. And yeah, obviously, when was I going to see it in a theater ever? So I was like, I guess I got to check it out. And unfortunately, I worked really hard this week, so I fell asleep through a big chunk of it. But I woke up at the end, and that's really the best part, is the two twists leading up to the end, about this guy who just spends his days kind of like people watching, and then he watches this one guy, and he finds out that this one guy, just his idea of having fun is just breaking into people's houses and taking like one thing, like not even like trying to get money or anything, just like screwing with people. And then as the movie goes along, and that guy teaches him how to do that kind of stuff, you find out that that guy has been suckering our lead character into following him so that he can frame him for a crime. And then there's like another twist after that, and I don't want to say any more, but yeah, it's great. And yeah, I guess the last thing I saw was another first time film, The Sugarland Express from Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Why
are they saying that's his first one? I guess maybe theatrical one.
Theatrical, yeah. Duel is a TV movie, but it's a pretty good TV movie.
Yeah, I got that on 4K.
Yeah. Sugarland Express is based on the real life of, what's her name?
Sugar.
Yeah. The Poplins, Clovis and Lou Jean. Lou Jean is played by Goldie Hawn, and they both went to prison for, I forget why, but she gets out earlier and she goes to Clovis's prison, and it's all minimum security because they weren't like huge crimes. But she's like, I just found out that our son is being he's in foster care and he's being adopted and we'll never see him again. So you got to come with me and go get him. And so she breaks Clovis out of his prison, and then right away they screw up and get busted by, like a state patrolman, I think. They take him hostage and they use his cop car to travel to, Sugarland, I guess. Sugarland, Texas. And
it's so sweet.
The police chief or whatever, he's gone like 18 years in the force without having to kill anybody. So it's his mission to apprehend these two without, you know, anyone getting hurt. And he leads like a statewide chase, to track them down. And it's really like, you know, you're watching, you're like, really, they're committing this many police to like this abduction? Like, it's nuts. And like all the destruction that ensues, as a result of like, just not like letting them go and like catching them down the road or whatever. Like, they know where they're going. They fully admit that they're trying to go get this kid. So like the plan is to like let them get to the house and then shoot them, like execute them before they get to like the
door. I haven't seen that movie in so long. Everything you're saying, when you haven't seen a movie in so long, you vaguely remember these parts, but my brain is not computing right now.
Yeah. It's just like they escape from like minimum security prison, and like they do hold a cop at gunpoint and like in the car and hold him hostage. But like, you know, they don't like rob a bank and kill a bunch of people before they leave. They don't kill the cop, and they know where they're headed. So it just seems like it's easier to just like let them go and then catch them at the house that they're going to. I don't know. You're the cop. You tell me.
It depends. Yeah. There's a lot happening there. You have to think about tactically what's the best way to do it. And if it's, there's a lot of factors. Yeah. I mean, if you know who they are and you know where they're going and they're not hurting anybody, I would do what we call just write a warrant for them and eventually get them, you know?
Yeah. Like, eventually, like, letting them go results in, they manage to escape and they stay in, like, a car lot overnight. But then, like, local townspeople decide to, like, go vigilante. And so they start shooting up the car lot to get them. And, like, in that process, you know, they shoot across the street, a bunch of cars driving by, they get hit, stuff like that. When the police chief or whatever finds those guys, he like empties their guns and then like berates them and then has them arrested. Yeah, all these cars get like wrecked. All these cop cars get wrecked in the process, and yeah, it just kind of escalates. But yeah, it's good first start from Spielberg.
Yeah, it's not one of his best ones, but it's, I mean, again, it's like Rian Johnson. You can see all the potential, and I mean, he's obviously one of the greatest directors of all time.
Yeah, I guess for 1974, there's like really creative driving shots that, you know, probably weren't standard for that day, you know?
Yeah, is Spielberg your favorite director?
I would say so, yeah. I don't know he was growing up, but I don't know if I have one now since I've seen so many movies.
Yeah, what would you say is what makes Spielberg so special?
Well, obviously, because it's where he puts the camera. You know, you put on the, you don't put it in the middle. It's got to be down below, and that put that horizon line away from the middle. Otherwise, it's boring. That's his signature, right?
Yeah.
According to Fablemans.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, because he just has this magic about how he makes film. Whether it's, you know, something that's quiet like Bridge of Spies or Schindler's List, but then he can make incredible action movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark or the War of the Worlds, you know, and he's just so great at making movies. And I think it's just, he's able to bring you into the world so effortlessly. I think that might be why. I don't know.
Yeah, without ever having seen like actually like work on set, you know, like I really can't tell you, you know, shot stuff, that's also part the cinematographer's decision. But, you know, working in tandem, he always just finds, like, he's really great at like finding a way to tell a story.
Yeah.
Without just like, it doesn't seem like he's following, like, oh, it's like he's not phoning it in. Like, if it's a boring talking scene, he'll move the camera around to like make it more interesting somehow.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right in that regard, because I can say something, you know, in E.T. where Dee Wallace and the kids are just at a table. He does bring the camera a little lower, and I wonder if he does that on purpose because, you know, the movie's from the kids' point of view, and that always has that sense of wonder in that film. Or something like Jaws, out of necessity of not showing the shark, then, you know, he keeps the film moving through performances and music. And I don't know, because I was thinking that, and he's so good. And I don't, he's, and I mean, everybody loves working for him. So there has to be something to him on set as well, you know?
Yeah. I think it's probably just passion. Like, it just seems like no matter how old he is, like, he just had whatever he's working on, he isn't phoning it in. Like, he wants to figure out what is the most unique way to do this.
You know, you're probably right with that, because every time he or Tom Hanks are talking about movies, I love hearing it.
Yeah.
You might be onto something there.
Like, yeah, there's just like a magic aura about everything he works on, you know?
Yeah.
That's it for me. What'd you watch?
I watched a few things. First of all, I watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure on Criterion.
Nice.
And that movie's, you know, sometimes when, I mean, I've seen it so many, I used to watch it all the time when I was a kid, but when you don't see it for a couple years and then you watch it again and you fall in love with the movie all over again, and it's just, it's a world where it's kind of a hyper reality, but we're living it with Pee-wee. And I don't know, there's just something about Paul Reubens and how he makes this person seem so innocent, yet he's not. And there's a little darkness to Pee-wee, the film. And, you know, it's just, and the way it's all set up, you know, when he's down in Texas and he gets on the bowl, and afterwards he gets knocked out, And they say, "Where are you from?" "I don't remember." "Well, what's your name?" I don't remember." "Well, what do you remember?" "I remember the Alamo." And then they all cheer. It's silly, but it's just so great. And I will still say this. It's probably my favorite Tim Burton movie. Because he's not straddled with being Tim Burton, if that makes any sense at all. You know, he doesn't have to have the big googly eye things, and it doesn't have to be gothic. It's just allowing him to be an artist. And I think that's to the what makes the film special.
Well, yeah, keeping with the theme, that's also his first feature. So he hasn't developed a style yet. I think in that movie, he's just kind of like throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah. And there's a great interview with him on the Criterion disc where he talks about that specifically, where, you know, he got his start in animation, but he wasn't a very good animator. So then he started looking at being more of a director and more maybe a cinematographer or designer. And so he said, "Yeah, well, I like this stuff. And that's why I put it, you know, in the Pee-wee movie, you know, claymation. And why not have a dinosaur in it? You know, I can put the nightmare scenes where you see the, you're right, the blooming of who he was going to be." Because, you know, when Pee-wee has that nightmare with the doctors and they're all clowns, that's a little Tim Burton-esque. But I think just the whole film is just really successful.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed, because I rewatched it recently too, is like Pee-wee lives in a town where like no one thinks that like he's weird or stupid. Mm-hmm. Like, other than the biker guys initially, like, everyone is like pretty, you know, like when he first turns on his water, like the neighbor's not like, "Oh, that I don't," like he doesn't act like he lives like a weirdo. He's like excited, like, "Oh yeah, sure thing, Pee-wee."
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, because I picked that up too, but you're vocalizing it. Yeah.
Whereas I think if that movie was made today, it would probably be treated like the Brady Bunch movie, where like they live in the 60s and everyone in like modern times is like, "Look at these weirdos," you know?
Yeah, because there's little great things in the movie. I love the movie within the movie, where he's playing the bellhop. You know, besides his voice, which is really funny, there's this moment towards the end where he keeps moving into frame.
Yeah.
So he's on camera. That's so brilliant. And it reminds me of one of my favorite commentaries is in my favorite movie. It's the Army of Darkness one. And Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell are talking. And Bruce Campbell is talking about an extra who drives him crazy in this scene. And that extra is literally doing that. When you watch Army of Darkness again, it's right after he says, you know, "This is my boomstick," and he goes on that little speech and he pushes the guy who's whipping him. There's an extra in the back who keeps moving with the guy being pushed and looking at the camera. It's pretty funny. So yeah, that's what I thought about. So that's a great film and people should watch it. I got the Arrow Evil Dead Rise, which is really cool. If you get it right now, it's still half off, so it's only $24, which is good because I have the 4K that Warner Brothers put out 3 years ago, or 2 years ago, and that one it has like two or three special features. I don't know if you remember, Brad, when it first came out on Blu-ray, it wasn't even on 4K and it didn't have any features. And then they put out a limited edition steelbook only at Best Buy that had one or two special features. And so this one has, maybe 2 hours worth of special features. And it's really fun. People talking about, you know, the challenges of making a low budget movie. And I totally forgot that was supposed to just be on HBO Max, but that it tested so well, they released it in theaters. And in fact, it was so successful that they have a new one coming out this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Evil Dead Burn is coming out in a couple months.
That's right. Yeah.
So excited for that. So, and it's a really great Blu-ray. I mean, it comes with it's not one of their big fancy ones, but it still comes with maybe a 20-page essay. It comes with the posters, reversible art, and then obviously the special features are the big selling point to me. And so it's another pretty cool little set that they put together. And that's why it's only $24. You know, their usual rigid case ones are usually like $65 before, you know, they get dropped, usually about $40-$45. So it's totally worth $25 if you get it. And the movie is great. I've never heard of Film Masters. They're a really small boutique label. But I did pick up, because I love Barbara Stanwyck, they put out a movie called Lady of Burlesque, one of their limited edition ones, which the slip cover is really cool. It's the old 1943 poster. There's a little pamphlet in it, probably 10 pages about the movie. And it only has a commentary and the trailer on it. But still, I mean, but they did a 4K restoration of the movie, which when I was listening to the commentary, it was in public domain, so that they kind of rescued it, and it looks great. The movie is pretty fun. It's a tame version of a burlesque show, and it's more of a variety show. Stanwyck dances, sings, but the arc overarching story is there's murders there, and it's kind of a bubble movie where everything pretty much takes place in this theater. It's based off a book called The G-String Murders. And so it's a murder mystery. There's comedy, there's dancing, there's singing. It's a fun movie, and it moves really quick. I think it's 82 minutes long. So it never really, you know, it just keeps moving. And the last things I watched is when I went and saw Primate. They had all these monkey trailers beforehand. So I rewatched Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And those movies are really good. Rise surprisingly holds up really well with their special feature, their special effects. When they get to Dawn, which was 3 years later, it looks even better. But yeah, I mean, tracing the rise of the Planet of the Apes. And it starts with them injecting test apes, chimpanzees, with this Alzheimer's cure. And what it does, instead, it cures the Alzheimer's in James Franco's dad, played by John Lithgow, for a little bit. But eventually the disease comes back, but the apes and the chimpanzees, they actually get smart from it, and they lash out at their captors, and they escape to San Francisco's Redwood Forest. And then Dawn takes place, I think, 10 years later, and where the simian virus is transmitted to people and it kills people, and society has crumbled, and the apes have made a home for themselves in the forest, and then they see humans for the first time in 10 years, and it sets off all this tension between them. And one of the apes who was in the first one, his name's Koba, he leads the apes against the humans, and it creates, which will be the next one, which I'll probably watch the next couple of days, which is War of the Planet of the Apes. Fun stuff. Incredible performances by Andy Serkis and Toby Cabe Cobell, I forget his name. Good stuff.
Is there another one coming out soon? Seems like it's been a while since Kingdom.
Oh, last year was Kingdom, which was a great movie. I don't know if there's going to have another one after Kingdom. That's what I watched this week. Next week, Brad, we're seeing Mercy with Chris Pratt.
Next week.
Yeah.
I'll watch it next week.
Yes.
Not early, because of Mundry Mystery stuff.
Oh, nice. So, until next time, we'll see you at the movies.
Well, a real nerd knows who shot a real nerd. Can follow the plot of a real nerd. Look at all the gods. Lights, camera, action. Real nerd.
Thanks for listening to Real Nerds Podcast, a Nebulous Visions production. Stream or download episodes, read articles at realnerdspodcast.com. Stream us on Apple or Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. Follow us on Facebook, Real Nerds Podcast. Twitter and Instagram, at Real Nerds. Watch us on YouTube, Real Nerds Podcast. Email us at realnerds@gmail.com. Call us at 720-6NERDS5. Thank you to Sparks Mandrill, Mike at Plan 9 Studios, and Bolognium for all of our groovy theme songs. And that's how you fucking do it.